photo interviewing Mr. Ron Lampe on March 13th, 2001 at the Westboro Public Library. Mr. Lampe, where and when were you born?
I was born in Gardner, Massachusetts, August 1929.
How long have you lived in Westboro, and or when did you move to Westboro?
We moved to Westboro in 1966, so basically 35 years ago.
What street do you live on, and did you always live on the same street?
Since we've been in Westboro, we've lived on Wheeler Road, County Wheeler Road, up off the west end, off West Main.
Do you have any siblings, and did any serve in the military?
I have one brother who's 8 years younger than I am, and he did not serve in the military other than the mandatory ROTC that they had at state schools many years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
But he did not serve on active duty.
Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about your town before the Korean War?
Okay, my town, at the time of the Korean War, would not have been Westboro. It would have been East Templeton, represented now in a high school by Narragansett Regional. So it's up in the north central part of the state. Very small. The four precincts of the town have a total of about 6,000, 8,000 people. So it was didn't even have a red light, had a blinking yellow light in the middle. So it was extremely small. And the type of town where everybody knew everybody else.
Yeah. What effect that you can see did the war have on your town?
Not much. Didn't change it very much. We just had a few more veterans marching on Memorial Day and the 4th of July. Other than that, not too much on a small town.
Did you visit home during your leaves?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I had a 30-day leave between stationed overseas and going to a post on the continental United States. So that I spent in the hometown. Between that and Worcester, where my wife was from. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you write and receive letters and cards from home during your service?
My wife and I wrote to each other every day. Other than that, I would get, say, two or three letters a year from my father, who would write in Finnish. He's a Finnish immigrant, so he would write to me in Finnish, and I would read it. But for him to write was a real chore. So I would get about four or five from him, but I got a letter about every day from my wife.
Every day?
Every day.
So you were married before the war?
I was married while I was in the military. At the Korean War time, I was stationed at Westover, and I was married about 7 days before I got shipped overseas.
Mm-hmm.
I had orders for overseas at the time we decided to get married.
Mm-hmm. It must have been difficult.
It was stressful for her more than me. She had to get a wedding dress and the invitations and all the arrangements, whereas all I had to do was to wear a bow tie with the uniform.
And show up.
incidentally, we did have our wedding cake baked by the Westfield, the Chicopee Air Base. I can't think of the name of it, even though I was stationed there.
So a military group baked
a military trip? Baker baked a cake.
Wow.
And the funny part is, the baker was a small, rather frail woman, staff sergeant, who did the baking. The decorator had was like a bartender, a big beer-bellied bartender who did the decorating. So we delivered it by having my brother-in-law drive to to the air base. And then I sat in the back seat holding a cake all the way to Worcester.
Well, since she wrote to you daily, you must have gotten a pretty good sense of what was going on here at that time, correct?
Yes.
Then you didn't have children before the war?
No.
You had children during or after?
After.
After the war.
Yeah. actually after separating from active duty, I was on active duty 25 months, and then I was in a reserve status for a total of 15 years, including the active duty.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, this isn't on our list of questions, but Mr. Lampe just shared his photographs with me and said that his son was in Desert Storm and was stationed pretty much near where you were stationed during the Korean War.
That's right.
That's really something. What was your life situation at the time you entered the service?
Student. I had just graduated from UMass. Then I can go to the second question. Did you volunteer or were you drafted? I volunteered in this way. At that time, land-grant colleges had mandatory ROTC, mandatory military training, for the first 2 years. Then you had an option for the last two. You could either continue with military training and get it commissioned as an officer, or you could just drop it. I dropped it. I had a fairly heavy scholastic schedule, and I was also swimming on the varsity, so my time was taken up. Then, when the Korea War became so-called hot, and they needed men, the quota for Air Force for the juniors and seniors was increased by about a dozen spaces. So I interviewed, my academic record was good enough, and I had won a cup for best in drill as a freshman. So I think those three things allowed me to get selected for the enlarged quota. So I went in via ROTC. It basically 1 year of ROTC instead of the normal two. That is, they normally have juniors and seniors, but I only took the senior. So I got in, volunteered through the ROTC into the Air Force. Mm-hmm.
What was your rank on separation from active duty?
I was a first lieutenant. Yeah, after 18 months, it's pretty much automatic. You go from second lieutenant to first lieutenant. I was one of the few that had been overseas and back, and I was still a second lieutenant when I got back from overseas, because I was only in about 3 months and I got shipped to Saudi Arabia. I was there 13 months and came back.
How did you find yourself in this particular service in the Air Force and not one of the other branches?
Well, one of the reasons for going to the Air Force is I thought I might want to fly. And also that's where the increased quota was, rather than the Army. It was in the Air Force at ROTC. So I just picked it. I did not qualified to fly, but I didn't know that at the time that I got into ROTC, and once I was in, I was satisfied with what the situation was. Yeah.
So you say increased quota, that's because the draft was still in place at that time?
The draft was in place, and also they needed to mobilize the country, so they needed more bodies.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like any war, you quintuple the number of people you have in the military,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's why they increased the quota.
What was the reaction of your family and friends when you entered the service?
Acceptance. It was accepted that I do that. My father came from Finland, where they had already taken on the Russians, and they just said, you have to fight for the country and you have to go. It was, I'm sure it was nervousness on their part that I survived,
mm-hmm.
but there was no negative reaction of family going into the service. Friends, they all went. It was a given. Once you get out of college, you're in the military. And some stayed in 30 years, and some stayed in, like I did, the 2 or 3 years and then got out.
So it was a duty.
It was just accepted that you would either get drafted or you might as well go on some other way.
And choose which branch you wanted
choose
to
choose if you can, yeah.
How long was your service obligation?
Basically, 2 years active duty. I spent 25 months active duty, and then thought of an indefinite reserve service. And once the Korea War wound down a little bit, that became 15 years. So I separated in 1966. At that time, I was a captain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where did you have your basic training?
At UMass, basically, at the university, classes and exercises. And that was about it. I lucked out. I really didn't get the physical basic training that most people do.
So you, that's your description of what training camp was?
Yes.
Kind of easy for you?
My training camp probably was at Westover Air Force Base for the first few months on-the-job training. I was with an experienced food service officer because I had majored in food science, food technology. They figured I could cook, which is not true, but for them it was close enough. And so my training was really at Westover Air Force Base, where there were 22 company-sized mess halls and one big consolidated office at mess. So it was good training there.
How many people were there?
I don't know.
Thousands?
Thousands. At Westover, yeah, that was, let's say, over 10,000.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you got 22 company-sized mess halls, each feeding about 200, and only about half the people eat at the mess hall, kind of judge it from that. And it's 10,000. It's a big base at that mm-hmm. time.
Was it the biggest in Massachusetts?
In Massachusetts, yes. Hanscom was the only other one that I know of, and Otis. And I think Westover was bigger than either one. It was a transport base and a takeoff spot for overseas. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you describe some of the people you trained with?
A lot of them were reservists that at the end of World War II had gone into the reserves and now were called back to active duty for the Korean War. So they probably had a hiatus of about 5 years of non-duty, civilian duty, they came back in. So those were the people I basically trained with. They were experienced in both military ways and in the job itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was a typical day like for you during basic training?
During basic training, like I said, I really didn't get into the basic training as it's usually considered, so a typical day was just a school day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
After basic training, what additional specialized training did you do?
It was in the normal, what they call supply services, which included normal supply of all kinds of materiel. And then specifically in food service, how do you run a mess hall? How do you count for meals? How do you get meals? How does the commissary decide how much food it's going to get? And, how much do you plan on per person eating of each one of the items? They call a ration factor. So much spaghetti per 100 people on a dry basis like that. So it was a lot of administrative type training. And then also, visiting and overseeing food service preparation, seeing with 22 mess halls, you sure got a range of good to bad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I learned a lot that way. That was basically the training that I had on the job.
Were you health conscious back then about spoiling food and things like that?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So you knew.
They know. The cooks know. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where was your first duty assignment?
Westover, Air Force Base.
And I think we covered this. What was it like?
Not bad. We didn't live on base. We lived off base. We lived in an apartment and commuted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Actually, we lived in Amherst. About five of us shared an apartment and we commuted. Took turns driving. Yeah. I didn't have a car, so I just paid so much per month for gas money. And,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So who were some of the people you worked with? Were they local people? Were they...
From all over.
Other parts of the country?
All parts of the country. In fact, when I had orders to go overseas, my wife went with me to the base. We stayed at a hotel in Holyoke, you know, waiting for a seat on an airplane to go to Saudi Arabia. We stayed with a couple who was the housing officer on Westover, and come to find out he was an All-American basketball player from Kansas. So they were from all over, really, all over.
So they stayed a while before they were shipped out. So you got to know new
Depended.
People.
If they had been in the World War II and then a reserve got called back, they were shipped overseas immediately, especially if you were a pilot, navigator, or bombardier. Those were the critical requirements for career at that time. In fact, I got sent to Saudi Arabia because my predecessor was a navigator and they needed him in Korea for bombing runs. They needed him in Korea, so that opened a requirement in Saudi Arabia and they were desperate. And I got sent over there pretty fast after I'd only been in 2 or 3 months and I was gone. Yeah.
So that was where you were first stationed during the Korean War?
Well, Westover and then Saudi Arabia, the Haran Air Force Base. Yeah.
So you didn't see battle?
No.
Being there?
No, we were ready for, I guess, battle in a way. We were ready to be attacked because we were only like 2 hours by air from Russia. And we didn't know at that time what Russia was going to do relative to the Korean War, the Korean situation. And then there was another Khomeini-type person in rule in Iran, Mossadegh. In his day, he was as fundamentalist and as anti-United States as Khomeini was. So we had drills, we had trenches, sandbags, we had training exercises if all the power goes out. And in addition, we had to have food for 30 days for people who would be evacuated from Tehran, which is the capital of Iran, and Karachi, which was in India. We thought that those two places, they would, if the war got hotter where we were, we would have to take care of those people on our base for up to 30 days. Yeah. So we had to have food available for them. I was food service officer for maybe 6 months, five or six months in Saudi Arabia. Then I went to the commissary where there I had to make sure the food was available. We had what we called chilled storage. It wasn't, it was cool. It wasn't really air conditioned even.
Not a freezer.
And we had freezers. We had frozen food. Yeah.
So a typical day. I mean, you're kind of describing what you were doing in Saudi Arabia.
Okay. A typical day in a mess hall. We had maybe 80 or so Italian civilians from Eritrea who did all the basic cooking, cleaning, baking. We had fresh bread every day, Italian bread, which is very good. And we had 13 military sergeants who were the shift leaders. They tried to get people with names like Stellato, Moretti, who spoke Italian. And then the administrative supervisor there was bilingual. And a couple of the other Italians were bilingual. These were Italian civilians from Eritrea, where Mussolini had abandoned them in 1935, 1936, when he fought against Ethiopia. And a lot of them had married into the local populace, and they said the discrimination in Italy was much worse than it is in the United States. Now, this is in 1950, so they had no country, and we would hire them to work on the base to be truck drivers, air conditioning mechanics, cooks and bakers and other food service workers. The dishwashing crew was Arab. Yeah. But the point relative to what my day was like is that they were old country people. So the boss is the boss is the boss. So I would go into my office. A waiter, we had waiters at that time, Italian waiters, would come in and see what I wanted for breakfast. So I'd get a custom breakfast served at my desk. I said, no, I don't want that. You know, I don't want special privileges. I finally gave up and accepted it. Because after 2 weeks of saying no and they ignoring me, I decided, okay. So they would start with breakfast. And then whatever problems would come up, either personnel problems, supply problems, We were trying to improve the dining hall. How do we do that? They were enlarging it, so there was a, what do we do in the meantime while they're working on one end of the building? How do we keep the dust and the dirt out of the other end? Mm-hmm. And you'll never have the correct mix of food that you want. For example, we were getting force-issued a lot of cold cuts and sausage-type meats, and too many. And I was getting, frankly, getting hell from my boss, the Lieutenant Colonel McQuiston, for not serving beef like stews or steaks or other, even Swiss steak. They did a beautiful Swiss steak off cube steak. And other meats. Why was I serving so much of cold cuts? And that's all the commissary said they had. So I asked the tech sergeant, food service sergeant, I said, what's going on? Something's going on. Something's not correct. So he got together with the commissary sergeant, and come to find out, the captain, who was a commissary officer, we were requisitioning 6 months ahead of time. Ordering 6 months ahead of time, what our base strength is going to be in 6 months. So he was ordering for 1,000 men, and we already had 1,700 men. So he was negligent on his duty. And I called him on it, and got him not court-martialed, but transferred to Germany on the pretense of a mental problem. So they said, well, since you blew the whistle on this guy, you know, here's a second lieutenant taking on an experienced captain. And they said, since you blew the whistle on it, you go to the commissary and get it straightened out. So I did. And so I got double education, the food service and then the supply end of it. And the master sergeants were wonderful. They really taught me all the details, the little nitty-gritty things and so forth. So. That was good about it, yeah.
Got a lot of experience.
A lot of experience. And you know you were in when they call you the old man, and you're only 22.
So at that time, you had a lot of civilian population working for you, and it was a good situation? You trusted them and everything?
Yes. Yes, I trusted them. They were, like you said, 80... in the mess hall, but we had like a total of 380 on base, Italian civilians. American civilians, we maybe had four or five nurses and a couple of secretaries for the colonel and the general, but they were like 380 Italian. So there was an Italian mess hall where they had their own menu, but it liked the American menu. I went over there. A food, but and they had their own lifestyle. Most of them were not thin, but they tolerated the heat extremely well. They dressed for it in shorts, blue shirts, and fine. I had no problems with them. Of course, the supervisors for the Italian mess, the dining hall, were Italian, so they took care of themselves more or less, and I just kind of oversaw it, and once in a while I walked through to make sure that the food was good. For example, the ration factor for spaghetti for Americans is 16 pounds per 100 men, dry basis. When it's wet, obviously. Theirs was 64. We have these rectangular metal trays, like you've seen in most dining halls. I don't know what the measurements are. They're probably 14 by 18 inches or something. They would fill the whole tray with spaghetti, whereas we'd fill one compartment. But they, it was good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was an experience. Arabs, obviously, non-fat, non-pork, non-fish, it was a kosher Muslim diet. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mostly, a lot of goat. I don't know where we got the goat. Mm-hmm. And lamb. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which the Americans, we didn't. A lot of rice for the Arabs. We had an Italian supervisor for the Arab mess, and the Arab company commander also, who was an Arab prince, also kept an eye on how they were feeding. So they ate well relative to a normal Arab military diet. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At that time, you're in Saudi Arabia. Did you know what the Korean War was all about? You knew what the fight was about?
Yes, I knew what the fight was about. And also, I was kind of kept updated by the pilots who would fly from Tokyo and in Korea and via Bangkok and Karachi and then land in Tehran. We had a rule where within 1 hour of landing, the crew of an aircraft had a hot meal in a dining hall. Usually it'd be a small steak and a lettuce tomato salad or whatever we have for salad making, cucumbers or maybe even a canned pickles or stuff like that, but, and bread, and maybe French fries. You know, it was a very
American,
fast meal.
But American-type meal.
It was American-type meal for the crew. So very often, if I didn't have anything to do, I'd go over and talk to the crew. Yeah, I met the Tucker, who was a quarterback when Davis and Blanchard were big football players at West Point. There was no Air Force Academy, but he had the option of going Air Force, and he did. And when we were finding out, we found out that people in Tripoli wanted to get on flights to Tehran just to eat in our mess hall. We figured we're feeding well. Yeah.
Good compliment.
Yeah. So I would learn a lot about from the crews as they come in. Yeah.
And you, so you knew what was going on in Korea. You knew who the enemy was. You
absolutely
knew.
Yeah, no, no question.
Was there a lot of literature or radio?
We had movies, so we would have the old RKO news mm-hmm. in those days that you see on the Turner Channel movie now. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, it was we saw a lot of news like that. An anecdote on that is that. It was one of the shots showed Ben-Gurion getting off the plane, and we had to formally apologize to the Arab local prince that we showed that. So it was a sensitive type of area between the Jews and the Arabs, and then, of course, on the other hand was the whole Korean War.
Right.
Yeah.
Nothing's changed now in the year 2001.
No, nothing's changed at all. No. In fact, another anecdote, we had an American military land on base, and he was Catholic. He had a medal that looked almost like the Star of David. I don't know what saint it was for. I'm not Catholic, but we didn't take a chance. We put him in a room, and C-47 took off at 11 at night with one passenger. Yeah. Because the Arabs would have shot him and then flown over to see what the medal was like. So it was a little, it wasn't totally peaceful.
Have you maintained contact with any of these old service people? Well, first from Saudi Arabia, and then maybe more local people.
I've kept contact with classmates who were in the military. I have not kept contact with any from Saudi Arabia. It's just that we've gone our different ways, and there were only like 13 to 20 of the mess sergeants. I have kept contact with one of my roommates that we shared a room, Kevin Hughes, who lives in Denver, Colorado. We've gotten together a couple of times. We visited them. He's visited here. Did the leaf peeping tour and stayed at our house as a base. And we visited him in Denver, and he took us to Pikes Peak and like that. So we've stayed in Christmas card. We stayed in touch with him. Then after Korea, I was stationed at a radar site in Tennessee, and there we stayed in touch with, he's died, but his widow we stay in touch with. She lives in Carson City. He was the adjutant at the radar site where I was stationed, and we were very close friends. So I've stayed in touch that way. Classmates are about the same as military mates because they all went into service at the same time, so we've stayed in touch with them too. It was not just for school, but it was also the military. We all did the same type of thing. Yeah.
So when you got stationed back here in Tennessee, did your wife come down and join
yeah.
you?
Yeah. Oh
she
yeah.
Did.
Yeah.
So she must have been happy.
Happy that I was there. We had a little of a problem trying to find a place to live. We finally found a nice town called Norris, which was built by the TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority, for workers who were building the Norris Dam. This is Roosevelt's big TVA program at the time, and one of the dams that he built was Norris, and this is a town called Norris. And it's strictly residential. I think there's one gas station, a church, a community building, a drugstore and a grocery store, and that's it. The rest is housing. We would almost love to retire there because it's like a park. There are no straight streets. They're all winding like a park. It is beautiful. So we finally rented a house that the workers had used, and then the local people had bought some of them for investment purposes and rented them out to people like us. So there were about three or four of us who lived in Norris, and we would commute to 12, 15 miles to the air base together. Yeah, every morning over the dam. Yeah, and on. Yeah, it was hill country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you enjoyed being down there?
We enjoyed Norris. We still keep in touch with one of our neighbors. She's about 85 and still drives, probably shouldn't, but she still drives a big Cadillac. So we stay in touch with her, and we visit her occasionally, you know, about every other year. We motorhome, so we have a motorhome, and we park it near, at a campground near there, and we visit with her. And we have visited, the old radar site is closed down, because the airspace over Oak Ridge is no longer restricted, and it's a mine, coal mine now. So we've been at the gate and looked in, and very sadly, motor pool still is there, but
things change.
Yep.
Do you belong to any veterans groups?
I belong to the American Legion, and I also am on the Westboro Veterans Advisory Committee. So I'm on, and I'm on the Korea War Commemorative Committee for the town. So that's about the only veterans groups I belong to. I'm willing to work, but I'm not really basically a joiner. I've done a lot of speaking to groups relative to what NADIC is, and in a way promoting NADIC. NADIC is for the, make the life a little easier for the individual military person. So, between the Legion and the advisory committee, and then with the I'm the secretary of the Korea Commemorative Committee, and that's a big job, that I do all the paperwork. And then the advisory committee, we put on a half-hour program every month on the local public access TV. And that takes a bit of doing, is deciding what you're going to say for information for veterans for a half an hour.
Right.
Yeah.
So since you've come to Westboro, you're pretty active, it sounds like.
Only after I've been retired. Before that, I had enough to do. I was a manager at NADIC. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had a division varied from 10 people to 37. So even at home, I would have stuff to do and read from 6:30 to 8:30. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would you recommend military service to young people today, and why?
Yes, with conditions. If you're not sure what you want to do, if you are not college-oriented, if you cannot afford college, the military is a good alternative, even for a short period of time. That's based on what I have seen at a DOD level for 25 years, and also interviewing a lot of ex-military, for example, some of the EMTs with the fire department in town, and they had good experiences. I do think that it is totally detestable that some of the military have to live on food stamps. Their pay is horribly low, horribly inadequate. Now, the military will, as a pilot, let's say, the Air Force loses a lot to commercial airlines. And I guess they get paid very high, a bonus for being a pilot. But for the average military they should get enough pay to be able to live as a normal person and to competently represent the military and be glad they're in there. They talk about, I've heard figures all the way from $750 a year, which is nothing. They might as well not even bother giving it to them. I would say they need between $500 and $700 a month more, depending on the rank and grade and like that, to make it. The people in the military now are there because they like the soldier, quote, soldier, whether they are in the Air Force or not. Another anecdote. We visited Nellis Air Force Base, which is where the Air Force's top gun fighter pilots are trained. We visited the dining halls. There were a group of us, a big committee named Food Service Equipment and Facilities Planning Board. We did all the planning of the dining hall design, the equipment that goes into the dining hall. We have responsibility for that. So we would visit select bases. And we visited Nellis, and we were told about a tech sergeant who was running one of the mess halls, that he served gourmet food. And we went in and ate, and he served gourmet food, really. And we said, how come you stayed in the military? Do you ever get a request from the hotels in Las Vegas, which is where Nellis is, to be a chef? He said, oh yeah, all the time. They want me to come over and give me quite a bit of dough. And I said, well, why are you staying in the Air Force? He said, I like soldiers.
There you go.
Yeah, we were lucky. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was black, tech sergeant, really ran a good mess. Yeah.
Do you feel your war experiences changed your life? And if yes, how?
Yes. I know what it's like. I know what the military is like now. Now, I would have to say it was both the war experiences and my civilian professional job at Natick for 25 years. They both given me a better appreciation for the military. I would say it caused my political philosophy to be relatively liberal internally, nationally. But internationally, I'm a hawk. I say we can, we still must maintain a strong military, because you will, and it's changing too. It's not a one-on-one battle. It's a lot of these scraps now, and it's also anti-terrorist. But we do need a strong, and we do need a military, and it should be good enough, that it's paid well enough so that you attract good people. Actually, the educational level in the military is higher than it is in the civilian right now. How long that's going to stay that way unless they shape up and make sure that the living conditions are adequate, which means living wage and respect. Yeah, I do respect the military. I think it's changed me that way. Yeah, it's affected me.
What was life like when you returned home after the service? Did you see any big change, or you lived in a small community at that time? So.
Not really. We were still basking, if you want to use that word, in the afterglow of World War II. We'd done well. We were starting our lives. I was probably impacted by the GI Bill, which was applied during the Korean War as well as World War II. I started UMass in 1947, and there were 1,800 students there. When I graduated, there were 4,500. This was the mass influx of World War II veterans on the GI Bill. So I was impacted by them. Some of them were older than the teachers. So the teachers, it was touch and go for some of them. I remember economics class. Boy, that teacher had a tough time. These guys had been out in the world. They'd been in the war. What are you going to tell them?
They had life experiences.
Oh, and some tough experiences.
Right.
Some real horrible ones, too.
But the GI Bill was a good opportunity for
people
to go back to school.
Tremendous, yeah.
Right.
And so I was impacted by association with a lot of them, some military-related Association. Other than that, not too much. I was an undergraduate at a state university, majoring first in chemistry, then in food science, and then I swam varsity, and then I worked as a waiter, dishwasher, food service worker in a fraternity house, and, for food, yeah, for board. Yeah. So, other than that, and life in East Templeton, from what I saw, had not changed other than a few more guys marching on Memorial Day and a few forces. At that time, serving in the military was accepted. It was not, it was nothing such as you got from the Vietnam War, where there was question. It was still that once in a while, well, why do we go to Korea? But nobody really answered the question, and nobody cared about the answer. They were still accepting that this is my job, this is what I should do. I trust the country totally.
Yeah. So you were received warmly when you came back home?
Yeah, I was received warmly by the community, but then again, I was right into grad school. Mm-hmm. I went to the food science department head. He was a World War II veteran. I'm very proud of what he had done there. He was in charge of supplying food for the military from Australia, what Australians could do to help food for our people in the Southwest Asia area. You know, the Philippines and the mainland and so forth, India. So he was very much pro-military. And I went in to find out where could I get a job. Like Smithfield Hams in Virginia was one, flour mill in Niles, Ohio was another. And then he said, but better than that, you get GI Bill and I'll get you half an instructor's pay and go to graduate school. So it didn't take long to say yes. You know, that was about $90 a week. It was like I was going to school and getting paid full. So I said, I'll try it a year. He said, you get a master's in a full calendar year. You got either a thesis or a problem, but it's a master's level thesis. And, you know, 9 months of classroom work and so forth. And then also I was given a class to teach. That's how I earned my half instructor's pay. So after a year, I was in the swing of things, so I...
Continued.
I continued, yeah.
So the GI Bill paid for the completion of your undergraduate, your math...
No, my graduate school.
Your graduate school and your PhD?
Well, which was my PhD.
Okay, so did you get a master's and then go on to a PhD,
yeah,
or it was all one?
Well, I got a master's first. I do have a piece of paper, a master's degree in 55. Then I had a PhD in 57. It's just the way the thing broke. I was extremely lucky that I was able to solve the problem I had and then also write the thesis and then get it done in 4 years. And I also had a bout with polio in the middle. So I was very, very fortunate all the way along that it didn't take longer than 4 years.
So your serving in the military really impacted your life.
Oh, absolutely.
Situation.
I would not have gone to graduate school. Yeah. As it was, graduate school really didn't cost me any. I was, okay, as an instructor, I was didn't pay any tuition.
Wonderful.
So it, no, the GI Bill. And I don't know, but it has done well by a lot of people. I know a lot of the people who use the GI Bill and what they've gone on to being. Now, I think John Smith was one of them, and he's the CEO of General Motors. Now, I don't know about Welch, the CEO of GE, but I don't know if they were on a GI Bill or not. They were UMass graduates. And Bob Mears, the CEO of Reebok, Blackwater. So I don't know if they were GI Bill, but I think the veterans impacted favorably on the school. They were motivated. A lot of my classmates just flunked out because they weren't mature enough to do it. Went in the military, came back, and got all A's. I know of two or three cases like that. These guys had already been motivated. Yeah. Kind of wild parties. They had seen some pretty tough action.
Wow. Well, so their life experience really impacted their life in a positive way.
Theirs and ours. You couldn't help but get caught up in a draft, so to speak, being with some of those guys and the maturity and the leadership that they would show. Even in the fraternity, the president was a veteran, and just the maturity he showed in leading, we caught by osmosis, if no other way.
You know, and they were older, too.
They were older.
They weren't 18-year-old kids out of high school.
No, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. No. And a lot of them had were fighter pilots and had seen a lot of action, were wounded. Mm-hmm. And they had some... one guy was a pilot, and he was so small that they had to build pedals, put blocks on the pedals for him to fly.
Okay.
Yeah. But,
what one lesson do you think we should learn from remembering the Korean War?
Not to do it again. Yeah. Not to let the world get to the situation where we let that happen again. Tend to believe in what Churchill said, it's better to jaw jaw than wah wah. Now that's probably impacted by my Finnish heritage as well as the Korean War, in that Finland is independent now and almost an embarrassment to Russia. But they also had a Korean War, or even Palestinian War type of situation. It was either we win this war or we're in the ocean. But to try to accommodate, to try to work things out, as we're trying to do in the Mideast, but not very successfully. But I think it would be to not let that happen again. And the other lesson from that is that we should be prepared. I think Merle, whom you'll be interviewing later, Merle Stratton, will tell you about the poor clothing and the poor preparedness that we weren't ready for the Korean War. From my experience that we're apt to get into another situation like this is that we have a tendency to get what I call a peacetime syndrome, that we buy a pickup truck instead of a Humvee. We will buy commercial packaging instead of military, really weather-resistant packaging. And when something like a Korea comes up, and it might, the Gulf War was one like that. And we did run into problems on resupply. The MRE ration, which I really was a developer, at least that's what they tell me. They couldn't keep the resupply going. We were using up the supply too fast. So we were not prepared, even for the Gulf War. It took us too long. We have let our guard down even on the helicopter problem in Kosovo. We couldn't keep our helicopters in the air. And that's the other part. Now, I hope we've let it go. I don't know whether you can blame the immediate past president, but Congress is there. They have an Armed Services Committee that is really the ones who control a lot of the military. And let's hope, even with a tax cut, that we can still boost up the military. I don't think we can do both, and do it adequately. But I believe that those are the lessons that the Korea War is not let it happen again. Just in case it does happen again, we must keep the quality of our military up high. Yeah, we run into the peacetime syndrome. You know, why not buy a pickup? It's cheaper than the Humvee. And they don't have the money. And then the maintenance is a real problem. Yeah. That's about the way I feel about it.
Okay, Mr. Lampe, thank you for your time. Thank you for sharing your memories with us. This has been an oral history interview with Mr. Ronald Lampe at the Westboro Public Library on March 13th. This is Nancy O'Dell recording.